Welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick and my co-host is Chris Lucian. And we're really excited today to have two guests with us, two other mob programmers, John Fletcher and Florian Schneider. And we're going to be talking about team-oriented development today and mob programming, pair programming, and parallel programming. So all kinds of programming. So to kick us off, we'll have John and Flo tell us a little bit about themselves. John, do you want to start us?
Yeah, sure. I'm actually Australian, but I'm living and working in Germany for Codecentric. And at Codecentric, we're allowed to come up with our own job titles. So I'm a lowly developer. And cool. Yeah, I like to develop. I am also interested in chaos engineering. I'm pretty involved in that. And yeah, but day to day working with a team development. And yeah, that's what I do.
All right. How about you, Flo?
Yeah, I'm a co-worker from John. I also live here in Frankfurt, work for Codecentric also. And I'm kind of a full stack developer. So more in the back end, but train hard on the front end things.
Nice. Right on. Well, before we jump into your guys' the topics in your excellent article, how did you get started with mob programming?
Yeah, I think we started this in one of our last projects where we need to focus on share knowledge. So we try several things out, like pair programming, mob programming, and all this stuff to get the knowledge spread, because we usually want to work with mixed teams. So guys from the customer and also guys from us. And yeah, we try to do a good way to share knowledge, and there we stepped into mob programming, which seems like a good way to do it.
Excellent. So, awesome.
It was actually the idea of an architect that was from our company as well. I mean, as Florian probably picked up, but we're consultants, so the company we work for is a consulting company. And this guy suggested that we do it, and then we just tried it out, basically.
Fantastic. Awesome. So is that something that you have now, you were at one company consulting with that company, started mobbing there, and then started mobbing with other companies that you were working with? Is that kind of how it worked out? Or
I don't know what Florian's experience is, because we were on the same project and now we're separated, but for me this is where it really comes into this question of team-oriented development. I don't know if you want me to answer that. I really need to jump straight into that subject.
That's a good segue. Please go ahead.
My opinion is that mob programming is a bit, at least the impression I had from conferences and people I talked to, is that it's a bit of a dogma where people are like, now we're doing mob programming. And I felt like that this is not the, mob programming is not the solution to every problem. It's a technique which might work for your team. And in a small amount or a large amount. And so that's something which teams need to find out. So right now I'm at a different project, on a different project. And on that project, we do a mix of different things. So actually I'm doing quite a lot of individual programming, believe it or not, programming on my own at the moment. But I don't really like it that much.
Yeah.
Especially because I don't mind it so much in an office or something, but because of the working from home thing we're all doing now, I get a bit lethargic when I have to program by myself.
The social aspects of mob programming while remote, I think we've heard from a lot of people now on this show, has had a unique benefit during this time where almost all of us are remote.
Yeah. But I mean, that's where there's a mix. So like today, for example, I was doing some pairing and there was another guy in the call kind of participating a bit, you know, so we're mixing it around a bit in that, in my current project.
Cool. And I guess that's maybe, that's the concept of team oriented development, right? Is maybe can one of you give a definition of it, so to speak, and how you came to discover it?
Yeah, let's say we try to find a mode for all of us during one work day, let's say. So we try to split up our day and say, okay, we give us a time box, do some mob programming, do this with different modes, like strict mob programming, where only the navigators allowed to talk, or more this freestyle mix. And you can figure out when you do this all day long, then this is hard. So you have to go back to some other techniques also. But I think in a project where John and I were together, we tried to do mob most of the time.
Yeah, we kind of, there was a certain amount of, like, it wasn't just like, oh, let's start more programming and then everything was great. There was a certain amount of resistance there.
Yeah.
That from us, from the others in the team, we sort of gave it up once or twice. And, you know, so that was definitely a process where we slowly became comfortable with it. And there was a lot of experimentation going on, actually. And sometimes this splitting up again initially was as a result of retrospectives and things. I don't know. We really tried to experiment a lot. And that's how we came up to all these things. And I think I coined the phrase team-oriented development. And then Florian and I had a bit of a laugh about it because it's TOD are the letters, which in German, it means death. TOD is actually means death. We had a laugh about that abbreviation. And I just came up with that idea because I thought, you know, it's not about doing mob. That's not the goal. That's rather a means to an end. And the end is really what Florian was talking about, this sharing of knowledge and strengthening the team, making people comfortable, making them happy to come to work, making sure they're learning a lot with what they're doing. And that all reflects, of course, back into the business and results in good outcomes for the business, people that stay in the team and work better. And yeah, Florian loves the term team-oriented development. So that's basically where we got to it.
Cool. Fantastic. Cool. So it sounds like, you know, while struggling with mobbing as maybe a dogma, at some point reframing what you were attempting to accomplish with mobbing helped. And so I guess I have a few questions about that. One is so when people split up as a result of retrospectives, what caused them to come back together as a mob as well? And I guess how did team-oriented development have an effect on that?
Yeah, maybe I said that wrongly to say we split up as retrospectives. That was more like at the start, like okay. I was sort of saying, is that a good idea? But then later the splitting up happened because more like Florian described it, just during the day we wanted to do different things.
Yeah.
I think that there's a natural, I mean, if you want to do mobbing 8 hours a day, then you need to coordinate everything. When people arrive at work, when they leave work, what time they have lunch, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, we found we just naturally drifted into a mode where, you know, the first person arrives and starts working, and then the second person arrives and starts working. And then, you know, so they'll probably be pairing then. And then a third person arrives, and then either that becomes a mob or they become, you know, or that person breaks off and does something else, you know. So it was just natural. And then at the end of the day, the reverse process occurs. And so we tried to also keep work for, you know, that's the sort of thing I can do in the morning when I'm the first one there. you know, things like that. So it became a kind of a way of thinking. And then I guess there's just times when people said, okay, that's enough. I've had enough of mobbing now. I want to do some pairing or something like that. So it was more like we didn't really have a schedule, did we, Florian? We kind of had a concept of more or less what we wanted to do, but then it was like, see how we're feeling.
Yeah, that's true. It is some kind of, if somebody need, let's say, a different task, then he picks some of our collected single fighter tasks, I call it like them, and he do something else, have a break from the mob, and that's fine for everyone.
Very cool. And then one thing I really love about what I'm hearing is that the team really adopted experimentation, right? And, you know, retrospecting and figuring out what works for the team. And I think that really fits. There's a couple of definitions of mob programming going around, and one's kind of more the more what people typically think, right? Which is, all the brilliant minds, same place, same time, same computers. That's like three or more at a computer working together, one computer, typically driver navigator type thing. But the kind of the second definition is like, let's work well together and turn up flow efficiency. That's exactly what you were doing as a team, even though you weren't doing like a strict pattern of mobbing navigation or something like that. And so I think that's really cool. And I think people, most people know what we mean by pairing and mobbing. One thing that I saw really unique about what you guys wrote about and are starting to talk about is this concept of parallel programming. Do you want to jump into that and describe that?
Yeah, sure. This was really funny because sometimes when we were into a mob session, then we came to a point where nobody gets the right solution, or where we struggle around and do some loops during the switches. And this was the time where we said, okay, because the one want to read a documentation, the one want to try something out on his own PC. And this was the time where we say, okay, stop. We stop here now, we set us a time box, and we work all on this task in parallel for, let's say, 20 minutes. So everyone go back to his own PC and works on this task and try to find a solution for the problem where we struggle over. And yeah, that was fine because after 20 minutes, let's say time box finished, we come back together and say, okay, let's see what we found out and discuss about this. And then we say, okay, your solution sounds good. Let's try it out in our application though. It was a fine way.
Yeah, and the interesting thing there is, there were times also when there was no time, it was more like somebody just solved the problem and said, I fixed it. You know, and that was like, that's a really interesting dynamic that gets created there because there's a kind of a friendly competition. You know, like if you're all working on the same thing, you want to be the one to figure it out first. Yeah. But it's a friendly thing. Like you're happy if someone else solves the problem because the problem's solved, but of course you're trying to solve it. You know, of course I know the best solution. I'm going to solve it. And what's very interesting is that one of the reasons people, or the arguments people bring for mob programming is what you mentioned with the flow, and in particular single piece flow is something out of, you know, Lean, which is considered good. And actually when you do parallel programming, you're actually still doing single piece flow. Mm. Actually, we're all still working on the same story. The same story is, or the same piece of work is progressing. And when you come back together to discuss, or one person then explains the solution you found, everybody immediately understands it. It's not like most of the time when somebody explains something to you in programming, it's like, oh, what is he talking about? But if you've been right there in that exact bit of code yourself, or trying to solve that same thing, it only takes a second, and you can just say, "Yeah, I did this, this, and this." Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
And so one tool, kind of follow up on that, and just to make sure I understand, because I think we've been doing it as well, and maybe didn't have a name for it. So you keep the video chat going in a remote setting, right? So it's like the video is still running, but we're all doing our own thing, and we can, like, I don't know, anytime I've done it, we'll be like, it's not this. And I'll say it out loud. And then someone else, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Hear the result of my experiment, you know, and
exactly. And sometimes you'll have one person that continues sharing their screen and another person is just actually still participating with that person. So it's not a strict, everybody has to do their own thing. There might be a group of two still kind of working together, or, you know, we did different things. We sometimes, I can't remember the different sort of variations, but the main thing is that you're giving everybody the freedom to pursue the course which he finds best to solve the solution. So normally they'll do their own thing, but yeah, sometimes somebody will have no idea what he's doing and just look over someone's shoulder. And I mean, actually, literally, some of us were in the same place. So you could literally do that and, you know, yeah.
So it's more about self-organizing rather than kind of like dogmatic mobbing. Is that a good way of putting it? Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't surprise me that you happened upon the same sort of idea, because I think it's, yeah, we gave it a name, which I thought sounded cool, yeah. I think it's a natural thing eventually. Like, you go nuts if you're trying to read documentation on someone else's screen, you know, and right when you're in the middle of something, he's scrolling it and then he's flicking to the IDE and you go,
Yeah. No, I think I've seen that pain in the past, and at times even in our environment, I've been asked, you know, is it okay if we don't mob, right? And I'm like, why ask that question? Like, of course it is. It makes sense. Like, there's definitely things that in the moment will help. And when we talk about mobbing, we're talking really about, like you said, a practice that can be very helpful, and something that was, I think, counterintuitive to the industry for many decades. I think now has kind of gotten to a place where it's okay to do, and where I think before it would have been harder to convince anybody to do it, right?
Yeah, I guess I have a follow-up question on your guys' transitions, but I guess I'll share a little bit of story from mine. And so I don't know if it was around the time I read your article or before, I don't know the timeline exactly, but ever since I saw the term parallel, and I'm like, oh, parallel program, I think we've been doing that. So we'll be working on a story, so to speak. And the big nasty part of the problem was solved as a mob, right? And it's a little bit kind of downhill coding. And so what will often happen is someone will split off and say like, okay, we got that figured out. I think you guys know what to do. And then we'll pair it. And then he'll go off and research the next big problem we're going to encounter, or something that he wanted to experiment on. And so that when we get to it, it'll be solved, so to speak, or have some stuff ironed out. I've also seen it where I think it sounded similar to your case, where we're trying to solve the same problem, and there's like, you know, 100 different experiments you can run, and everyone's computer has the ability to run the experiment. And why not, instead of run one experiment at a time as a mob, why not run your experiment on your computer and then share it with the group by keeping the video chat open? And so I think I've seen both of those happen for us. But what's cool is the leaving the video on all day. So even when someone else is researching another task, sometimes he's listening and sometimes he's not, but sometimes he will be coding and all of a sudden be like, wait, line 10, do this. And we're like, oh, so you're still here. Yeah. just the fact of having this, the video still on, you're still aware of issues that pair, that mob that you split off from, would have fallen into the pit, so to speak, unless you were there listening. And so I think it's been a wonderful pattern we used at times. And I guess my follow-up question is, you talked about it a little bit, and it sounded like there was no formal transition between mob, pair, parallel, or single. Was it just basically completely natural as the day goes? You know, how are the transitions between each style, and what are the things that led to the transitions? Yeah.
That's a good question.
So it sounds like one thing was schedule, right? So if you're not all, like in our current mob, we're all time synced. So we all pretty much start at the same time, eat lunch at the same time, and end at the same time. But if you're on a team that's not, I think it'll naturally lead to this, you know, I'm the only one here, so I'll solo it. And then when someone arrives, they'll review what I did, and then we'll pair it from then on. Or yeah. Was it the type of work, or?
we did daily retrospectives,
yeah,
which we found worked really well for us. And as a result, we did so much reflecting and experimenting and stuff. At some point, it's hard to kind of draw a definite clear thread. I think that we sometimes had the situation that the morning thing, while it worked for us, it sometimes resulted in us saying we got to 12 o'clock and we still hadn't really got into the mob or something like that, because we'd sort of, and we weren't, then we said, hey, we shouldn't do that, we should get into the mob earlier. And then we definitely tried some things where we said, okay, between this time and that time we're going to do some kind of strict mobbing. We had a period where we did this really strict mobbing. We call it strict. This is also, we kind of invented our own entire vocabulary. And the strict mobbing, as Florian mentioned, is where nobody's allowed to speak except the navigator. And that's a really interesting
Yeah, so no one can talk to the navigator. Only the navigator can speak.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah.
So more strict than our strict.
That's more strict than our strict.
It's really like a dojo. It's really like a practice thing, yeah. Right? Because you're practicing not speaking, which is an important thing to practice as a developer. Knowing the answer, not pushing on the thing.
You're patient. You train to be patient as one of the mob, and the navigator trained to speak out loud what he's thinking.
Yeah, that makes
you
sense.
Can sit there sometimes getting totally frustrated because you can see the answer, but the navigator can't see it, and that's part of the exercise. So it's really a fascinating thing. You should try it out, but you can only do it for a limited time. You go crazy after a while. And yet it's very peaceful. That's a strange thing. Like sometimes when you have what we call freestyle, which is like everybody can talk whenever they want, sometimes that's quite stressful, because then people are trying, are sort of suggesting another idea and throwing another, you know, there's so much discussion. You say, God, let's just do something. And then you go into the strict mode and it's totally peaceful. It's just quiet. You're just watching the code getting written, thinking about it, deciding what you're going to do when it comes to your turn. It's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I've experienced that style in some maybe like training environments, right? Like you said, dojos, for example. It is a good experiment if one can speak except for one person at a time, that sort of thing. Yeah, that's good.
To answer the question, there were times when we sort of said, hey, we want to do that first thing in the morning for the first half hour. I want to do two rounds of that. Or whatever, and then we'll move on to this and that. And so we had periods where we had a kind of a structure like that, and then we had other periods. I mean, of course, sometimes people were on holidays, and, you know, there was always something going on that made it that we didn't really have a fixed kind of thing. We just it was really a matter of how things were going that week, that day, how we felt. We just transitioned between different things, and maybe we did more or less mobbing on a certain week. Is that right, Florian?
Yeah. I think in the beginning, also we adopt some more rules, let's say. So we started mobbing with, let's say, do a time box, 45 minutes, do some rounds of mob programming, and then have a break. Everyone goes out for 10 to 15 minutes, something like this. And during the project, this switched a bit. So when we do mob programming, we do it, let's say, for 2 or 3 hours, and everyone who needs a break go out. So we don't have fixed breaks, for example. And yeah, this was a flow of changes, let's say.
Nice. Yeah, and I think I'm inspired by the different styles you guys have tried out. So this, I'm going to call it strict navigation.
Just
give it meaning in our context, because it's more strict than our strict navigation. But I think you're right. I mean, the ability to practice not speaking, because I have a tendency to dominate in a mob, right? And so I think for a short interval, it could be really effective for a mob to do so, to give that opportunity for others to verbalize intent and those kind of things. And the piece you've talked about with having a more strict style. So, you know, I think you open it up, as you said, you know, to be more freestyle. And then there was one case I'm thinking of in particular where we were trying to fix this really nasty bug. It was really complicated. It was some old code. It was really hard to understand. It was a lot of interactions between different tools. And we were going at it freestyle for a while. And it started to become really stressful and chaotic. And then what we did is we didn't go strict, but we went pretty strict. And we said, hey, we need to all be of the same mind. And so we went to a more strict style of mobbing where we visualized, okay, we tried experiment A, it didn't work. All right, what's the next experiment to try? And then it was like very methodical. And after a day of that, we got to the bottom of it. But the day before was like a day of freestyle chaos. And so I think one thing I'm learning is you feel the problem out, and then you naturally adapt to the style that's needed for that moment, right? I guess there's a lot of things going on. Stress levels, emotion, complexity of the problem, schedules, right? So there's a lot of factors. And so it's hard to define when you do this style versus that style, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anything else on the team oriented programming? I had a follow-up tangential question, something you guys mentioned earlier, but anything else on that before we jump topics?
I suppose a few other points to that might be interesting. I talked about the new project that I'm on now, and that's where we're doing a certain amount of, I mean, we've done some mobbing, mm-hmm. we've done, but not, I didn't, nobody called it mobbing, we just sort of did it, you know? Yeah. And we've done, you know, we're doing a certain amount of pairing and a certain amount of single programming, single fighter. And I think like my approach to it has been so far, like I don't want to go in there and say, hey, we're all going to do mob programming now, because I know what I'm talking about. You know, I feel like that's like the way I approach it is I've got to go in there and see what they do. And that's an existing team that I've joined and adapt to what they're doing and kind of integrate myself and demonstrate to them that I'm, you know, competent and, you know, sort of win a certain amount of respect and then gradually bring ideas in and then get there. That's kind of how I see the progress there. And that's, I guess that's part of the whole approach. I mean, of course, if you come in as a mob programming consultant, then it's expected that you're going to do mob programming, you know, and I've actually done, some mob program teams came to me for help, and I've actually done a little bit of mob consulting, which is kind of interesting and fun work, which is of course something different. But for me, it's really a question of you got to win buy-in from a team if you want to do things which are unnatural. Otherwise, they're going to revolt against it after a day and kick you out, kind of kick you out or kick out the idea to their own disadvantage. So that's really, for me, that's part of the whole thing. But I do also believe that, like, for example, the strict mode, as we called it, is a bit of a, yeah, how do I say that? That's something that feels unnatural, really unnatural, and is actually quite painful in a way. It's quite difficult and frustrating. And then at some point, one sees the light and says, wow, this is really cool. Like, at some point, I saw somebody start, I knew the answer, and he didn't know the answer, and I couldn't say anything. And then 30 seconds later, he worked it out. And then I knew that had I explained it to him, he would have understood in a sort of way less than just by me being quiet and letting him work it out. And that was like an aha moment for me. And I thought, hey, this is good, this thing. And so we've got to have those aha moments. And I think there's a kind of a tension between, on the one side, getting the team to, you know, let the team choose what they want to do, you know, find their path and getting that buy-in. And on the other side, saying, how do we get people to do something unnatural and stick with it and saying, guys, we're going to stick with this thing for a bit, because you do have to sort of push through a bit to get the benefits eventually. And I don't have the full answer there. Just want to throw that out there on the table as an interesting side to it all.
Yeah, definitely. And I think to your first point, if you aren't going to say it, Chris, I think I'll say it, the center enter turn. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris, on that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, so it's just I think you reminded us of some advice that we had gotten from Esther Derby about joining new teams. It's kind of like center yourself and understand what understand the team that you're in, then become part of the team, and then begin to turn it after you've, you know, gained that respect, so to speak. So that's a pattern that we've heard of a number of times in organizational change efforts and things like that. And so that's a really positive technique, and I've seen that work very well over time, because the worst thing you can do is just join a new group of people and start telling them that they've done it wrong, right? I think that's very very smart thing. And do you have more, Austin? Is what you're saying?
Oh yeah, and then on your second point, with allowing others to discover for themselves, and you know, don't steal the learning, right?
Yeah.
Kind of yes anding to your thing earlier about continuous experimentation and retros is, I was on a mob about a year back, and we were working really well together, and we committed to give, you know, unfiltered feedback. There was one retro in particular where we did that, and their feedback to me was basically step back from contributor and more let them discover the path and just be a guide, right? And so it was really cool, because I think I have a tendency to dominate, right? Or to speak too much. And you can move the code forward, but you're not optimizing for learning anymore. And that optimizing for learning will eventually be the best thing for the product and the company. Mm. I think you said strict might be the answer. It might be a pattern to try if you see the anti-pattern of, there's one person in the mob who explains everything and solves every problem and, you know, only let someone think through it for more about a minute before they give him the answer. And I'm somewhat describing myself. So
that's a big Andy Patton. It's a big Andy Patton, which you have to,
yeah,
to listen for. I can give you another tip on that. And that is, there's a well-known Google study where they worked out about emotional safety being a really important thing for teams.
Yep.
And one of the things which they uncovered during that study is the researchers went to teams, and they looked at meetings, and they counted how often people talk during a meeting. And they came up with this statistic they call the equivalence of conversational turn taking. And basically it means, in a meeting, does everybody speak around about the same amount, or does one or two people dominate the conversation? And what they found is that in high performing teams, there is a high equivalence of conversational turn-taking. And obviously that can, I believe that kind of concept, it's a fascinating thing. If you look at that in meetings, next time you're in a meeting, just observe that. It's really interesting. And you can apply that to mob programming as well. You know, how often is everybody contributing? Because if we can get to a situation where everybody's contributing a fairly equal amount, you'll create a very comfortable environment where people feel very happy being in it, and it's very productive.
That's a metric, that's a loose metric that I've been telling people for probably 6 or 7 years now, is if you're in a mob of four and at the end of the day you can't honestly say that you all spoke about 25% of the time, then there's probably something that needs to be shifted a little bit.
Nice. Yeah, what was interesting once is we had some visitors, and one of the visitors I think has already done this with several mobs, but he had a very special keyboard. I mean, it didn't look anything like this keyboard, but it was a special keyboard that had, like, each key meant a different metric he was tracking.
Yes.
And he was tracking the metrics of the mob. And so, like, when I spoke, it was like the blue color. When someone said a joke, it was like this key or whatever. And I think it went into a spreadsheet, right?
Yeah.
Of, like, you know, and I think, unfortunately, since I was a living example of the anti-pattern, but I think I was trying to explain to the visitors what we were doing. I think, didn't you say, Chris, the graph was like all me, you know?
Yeah, or something. Yeah. That's okay.
But I think we've also joked about Chris installing a voice detection on our mob stations, right? So.
Oh yeah, Python. You can say was the contribution roughly equivalent for all the speakers during the day using a Python voice classifier.
Nice.
I'm totally joking, by the way. I haven't made it yet.
All right, so I think I'll go on one tangent before we close out the show, just because it felt like a unique opportunity here. So John, you talked about chaos engineering, And I think Chris here is a living example of team chaos engineering, I would call it. So maybe we'll give a little bit of time for that. John, can you start us with your interest in that?
Yeah, this is actually, believe it or not, it relates to mob programming in a funny way. And I'll tell you why. Basically, I got involved in it because there was a guy that worked at our company, and he was building circuit breakers and things like that that he needed for his software. You needed a way to test it. And in the end, he wrote a plugin for Spring Boot called Chaos Monkey for Spring Boot, which allowed him to, you know, create certain, you know, latency, tell a service to respond slowly or tell a service to return exceptions and things. And then he could check whether his circuit breakers were working. And this this plugin took off, and eventually the CEO of our company said, why don't you start a startup? And a chaos engineering startup. So that's what he did. And he kind of said, who can take this thing over and who can keep running chaos engineering in this company? And he got a few of us involved, and that's how I got involved and learned from him and took over the project. So I now maintain Chaos Monkey for Spring Boot along with a couple other guys. And basically that's how I learned about chaos engineering. Then I just started going to customers and doing it. And for those that don't know, chaos engineering is really about the fact that a system is just, you can't really know how a system's going to react. And often we test unit tests and even integration tests, but these days architecture's happening, you know, between things like microservices on a massive level. And we need to know what's going to happen when one service goes down, because you can have cascading effects that bring the whole system down, you know, things like that. So with chaos engineering, we intentionally create those errors, and then we see how the system reacts, and we try and learn from that and then build more resilience into the system. So that's kind of the traditional thing of chaos engineering. But even from the very start, the people that started it at Netflix, they talked about six levels, and they have like people, process, and something else. This is kind of soft level. So it's not just there's infrastructure and software and things like that. And then there's this people and process levels. And what they say is, like, what you can do is you have what's called a game day, where you get a whole team together. And then you say, right, let's switch off the database and see how the system reacts, and whatever your experiment might be. And what you'll inevitably see is that one person, you know, I'll look at fly flying on here. Well, you'll inevitably have one person who knows, who's kind of takes over. So yeah, do that, you know? And then it can be interesting to say, okay, next day, that person is not available. You know, we'll sort of let the rest of the team work it out. You know, and you do things like that on a people level. And what we're finding is we're going in, like, I've got a friend, another colleague who's really, I'm just doing chaos engineering a bit on the side, like according to demand, but he's like basically doing it full time. And he's got it to a point where he goes to teams to do chaos engineering, but then they discover that, you know, what this team really needs is knowledge sharing. You know, or what they really need to do is to understand how to apply certain techniques. It might even be test-driven development or whatever, you know, but he identifies needs that are more important than what happens when the database gets switched off, you know, but even sometimes through the chaos engineering, you identify these things. And so he's kind of taken a step back, and for him, chaos engineering consulting has become, I don't even know how you can explain it. I don't know if there's a word for it, but something like team technical competence consulting or something.
Yeah,
and that's really interesting.
Yeah,
and so he said to me, look, when we need you, can I bring you in and we can do some mob programming, or you can teach them something else? I said, sure, let's do it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think the reason Austin brought it up is I'm giving a talk on a very similar subject in Lisbon. Well, I'm not traveling there anymore now, I'm just doing it remotely, but in the September timeframe, it's kind of chaos engineering for teams, or this was at the Big Agile, which I think is now canceled. But the idea is we've even put certain things in place, like no one can be on a team for more than 2 years, and in the last 3 years, things like that, to ensure the knowledge sharing is happening. And it was kind of funny that you mentioned a database kind of game day. Because I think we literally just did one of those where it's just show that this system works, and then if there's only kind of like look out for things, like if there's only one person that knows how to do it and stuff like that, right? and you know, do it as a mob so that the process is shared, you know, and things like that. So it's funny because, you know, exactly everything that you said there is stuff I've been thinking about pretty often. So
yeah. And, so Florian mentioned the knowledge sharing, and there's this concept in Agile of bus factor. Yeah. So maybe there's a connection there where you can just artificially take some, I mean, people leave anyway for holidays or whatever, but you can take someone out and see what happens. I think that's quite interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we do this, you know, we do this as kind of a real-time process in our environment now. So if somebody becomes too much of a knowledge silo, then we just ask them to move to another team. And so it's like, okay, you just don't work on this anymore. People can ask you for help as much as they want, but you're on this team now. And what I've seen it do is it's starting to incentivize people that become kind of like the hero role. It starts creating an incentive for more documentation so that they're not asked as many questions when they leave the team. And things along those lines, which can be really beneficial. But and communicating with others and getting that a little bit of that tribal knowledge up so that they don't become the single point of contact when they leave the team. And so we've seen that with a couple of people. So when we've had mobs be around for 3-4 years, there are some mobbers in particular that have become, you know, they're the one go-to point for this type of information, and people kind of just like turn off their, you know, stop thinking about that problem because they know, oh, this person has it. And so now there's like this understanding that that person's going to be off the team pretty soon. So we should really all understand it. And that's been really cool.
Yeah. And one thing when you mentioned about documentation, we've been trying to be good as a mob to, before we leave work and call it done, before we check the box as green, not just proof of concept, but good, is the code readable? If we walked, all three of us or all four of us walked away and someone else was reading this, would they be able to understand? And I know that's impossible to answer, but it's a good exercise, right? And then the same thing in terms for the pipeline or delivery code, right? And so the pipeline works and runs is not the end of the story, is can someone else read the pipeline? Because it basically tells you the story of how this goes from, you know, inception from this stage, you know, from these parts of the infrastructure to the other. Can someone else pick up this pipeline and go? Is it documented in the code, so to speak? So I think all those experiments, Chris, have had their effect. We are asking those questions quite a bit.
And I think that, just pinning onto that, I think that if you think about it, sick leave is a kind of a natural chaos engineering. It just happened. And what people tend to do, or can do sometimes, holiday leave is another one, but it's at least planned. But what people do in these cases is they allow themselves to be contactable. You know, and you just ring the person that's on sick leave or on holiday.
A big anti-pattern.
Sorry?
That's a big anti-pattern, right?
Yeah. You're basically breaking this great opportunity to force your team to force your documentation to be there, force your code to be readable, to force other people to be able to get on without you.
Yeah.
Suddenly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we might be hitting our... go ahead, Chris. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say... that's why, you know, this is a pretty strong opinion I hold now, but I would recommend to every team out there to try the process of, if you have more than one software team, is people should not really be on the same team for more than 2 years. I think it actually causes a lot of bad behaviors, and there's probably other ways around it, but I've just seen, you know, putting this small rule into effect has really had a lot of positive benefits around it that are not super intuitive. So might be a good experiment to have for maybe a 4-year period. See how it goes.
Cool. Well, I think we're hitting our time box, but I'll turn it over to Flo and John to share or plug anything else you like. So I guess we can go ahead and start with you, Flo.
All right.
Yeah, it was just anything you'd like to share before we close out the show, anything you'd like to plug before we call it a wrap?
Oh, no, I think everything was said, and I can recommend to all the guys out there, try to do some more programming, pair programming, try parallel programming, that's really cool, really awesome. Try to stick to this single piece flow, that's really important.
Fantastic. Cool. How about you, John?
I would say you hitched onto one article we wrote about the team-oriented development. We wrote an earlier piece about mob programming itself, and we'll give you the link there. And that's where we've also described what we've called the strict and the freestyle, and we've got one in the middle. Yeah, I forget what we call that, but semi-strict or something. Well, that's where the three approaches are described, and a few other tips and things which we discovered in mob programming. And the funny thing about it all, if you read the other article, it's kind of entertaining, because we basically pointed out that through all this, we really increased the bus factor. And the irony of the whole thing is that when you do that, nobody wants to leave the team anymore. You know, when you create that environment, and that's what we achieved in that team, that none of the developers wanted to leave, you know, none of them left during that team, which is, it's a sort of a fascinating irony of the whole knowledge sharing thing.
Yeah. Fantastic.
I've experienced that exactly. Like, I don't want to leave my current team, even though I need to sometime. Yeah.
Yep.
So, with that, like and subscribe, please give us feedback. Huge thanks to John and Flo. This was incredible learning for us, and we really appreciate your time. And until next time, have a good one and mob well. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.